We come to Matthew chapter 5. Tim is going to preach from the passage that's entitled Retaliation there. Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 to 42 is what I'm going to read, and then I'll hand straight over to Tim. So Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 to 42. Again, Jesus finds a sort of mentions a quote that is known by every people, all the people, and he just says, right, you've heard this, now let's think about it a bit deeper. That's what he does again here. Verse 38. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you.
I guess one thing maybe to mention on top of stuff from the bulletin is the funeral service for John Hodgins. Just let me point out that's 2 weeks on Monday at 11 o'clock here. Details are all in the bulletin for that as well. Well, we come to this passage on non-retaliation. Probably one of those which has been most misunderstood. It's not hard to see why, is it, when you read it, again, as we've just done. But I say to you, says Jesus, do not resist the one who is evil. Really? Someone breaks into my house and I show him round and tell him where the valuables are, if I have any. Or someone tries to attack someone in the street and, I'm here as well, have a go at me. I mean, what is going on here? Is this just unrealistic idealism from Jesus? I've quoted him before. Patrick O'Brien writes books that I really enjoy, and he writes about Captain Jack Aubrey, who's at sea. And there's a quote from Captain Aubrey about why he really hates having vicars and priests, clergymen, on his ship. And it's basically because he knows that they're going to preach the Sermon on the Mount or something to the sailors, and then they're going to have to go off and fight the Spaniards. And the two just don't seem to fit. He says this: it seems to me uncommon odd and precious near to cant, or unsincere talk, to tell the ship's company of a man of war with loaded guns to love your enemy and to turn the other cheek, when you know damned well, I'm quoting, that the ship and every man jack aboard her is there to blow the enemy out of the water, if he possibly can. So what do we do? Well, if Jesus' teaching seems unworkable or a bit ridiculous, if any of the Bible's teaching, we need to think again, don't we? We need to go back and check we're understanding it properly. We need to remember the situation that Jesus is addressing, for one thing. Think about the context of the Sermon on the Mount. We constantly need to be remembering who Jesus is speaking to. Chapter 5, verse 1 tells us he's speaking to his disciples. In other words, those who have made a conscious decision to follow him, to leave other things behind and to follow Christ. We need to see it in the context of the Beatitudes as well. Those initial statements, blessed are the poor in spirit, verse 3 and so on. Because he's talking to people whose relationship with God has been radically transformed. Because they are now, they know a poverty of spirit that they didn't know before. They're sorrowing for sin, verse 4. They're hungering for righteousness. So their relationship with God is totally different. And their relationship with others is different as well. I think there is a sort of alternate relationship with God, some verses, relationship with others, the other. So blessed are the meek, is our relationship with one another, and blessed are the merciful, and so on. Blessed are the peacemakers. The life is not the same when you follow Jesus. And he's talking to those people He's not just writing a textbook and saying, this is how to run a country, this is how to run your state and your police force and that sort of thing. And a wider context of the whole Bible, of course, should make us think there are parts of the Bible that address defending yourself. So Exodus 22, you can read what it says about self-defense, defense of your family and home. It's got to be proportionate. Go to those passages if you want to think about self-defense, or Romans 13, if you're talking about someone who needs to be punished in society. It talks about the sword of state that the Apostle Paul says God has placed in the hands of the authorities to punish evil. Evil should be punished. It should be resisted in that context. So if we want Jesus' teaching, if we want the Bible's teaching on those other things, we need to look elsewhere in the Bible. The quote from verse 38 is something that appears three times in the Old Testament: an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And the purpose of this law was a judicial one. So if we were to go back and to look at all the three times that it's quoted in the Old Testament, which you can see there in the footnotes, we'd find that these are commands given to judges in how to administer justice. We'd find that they are in order that they give that justice in a proportional way. Don't over-punish somebody. And that actually the whole point is to limit the vengeance on somebody who's done wrong. And so this is something, these are laws in the hands of the judges. Now what seems to have happened at Jesus' time is that it's been distorted. And they seem to be applying, the Pharisees and scribes in particular, seem to be applying this law to personal vengeance. So when someone wrongs you, you've got the right to take an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It was given as a responsibility to make sure it was done properly and legally and only one eye taken and no more. But it has now become this sort of personal right. And Jesus, first of all, gives the principle of what he wants to say. But I say to you, this is verse 39, do not resist the one who is evil. This is the big principle here. So as we think through these verses, we've thought about the situation that Jesus is addressing, this particular law, and how it's being distorted. Now he gives this principle in verse 39, the first half of it, of non-retaliation. And it's so easy to go wrong at this point, and I think the King James Version had a more of a do not resist evil, but the ESV and most modern versions will say the evil one. This is about the person who is evil. It's not don't resist sin. The Bible says yes, resist sin. It's not don't resist the devil. Yes, we're to resist the devil. It's don't resist the one who is evil, the person who is doing evil to you. And we need to look carefully what it actually says. I know it's hard to tell in the English, well, it's impossible to tell in the English, but the you in the following examples that Jesus gives are in the singular. You know that in the Greek. He's saying if anyone would sue you, for example, in verse 40. These are personal issues. If anyone, verse 41, forces you to go 1 mile. He's talking in the singular, which helps us to realize this is not in the area of the state and applying punishment in certain situations. This is when people wrong you personally. So I want to summarize what Jesus is saying like this. Jesus is about to give four examples. And these are instances where self is made small in the world's eyes. Our natural reaction in situations like that is to defend self, to lash out, to react, to defend ourselves. That's our natural reaction, isn't it? Our reflex. But to his disciples, Jesus says, when self is under attack, don't defend it. Reason? You live for a higher boss now. To be a Christian is to say Christ is Lord. So Christ has taken the place of self. Grateful that Michael quoted that from John the Baptist earlier. Jesus must increase, I must decrease. I think that's a great summary of actually what is going on in these verses. Now let's look at the examples and how Jesus takes this principle of not resisting the one who is evil and how he applies that and shows how we're not to react to defend self, but actually we're to react in a way that cares about our higher calling, our higher cause, our higher boss, Jesus, and his honor, and the opportunity to be salt and light in the world. So let's look at the examples. First of all, you've got in verse 39, the second half of it, when my personal dignity is under threat, when my personal dignity is under threat. So this is where Jesus says, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. On the surface, this looks like an assault, doesn't it? Physical assault. But actually, we need to understand these things culturally, first of all. And even today, a slap on the cheek in some parts of the world means something different. So if in the Middle East, and really interesting talking to Hussein and Marjan this week from Iran, they recognize this immediately. A slap on the cheek is the worst sort of insult. And that was precisely the case in Jesus' time. In fact, if someone slapped you on the cheek, it's not so much a physical assault. It was just, it's a massive blow to your dignity. And you could take them to a court of law and they would be liable to pay you damages for that slap on the cheek. It's not the pain, it's not the damage done. It's the affront to your dignity. Now, just think for a moment. If I were to slap Michael, I'm not planning on doing it. I have no reason to do so. Lots of reasons not to. If I were to slap Michael, which cheek would I get him on? If I were to slap you, I'd get him on the left cheek, wouldn't I? Because I'm right-handed. The assumption is that most people are. Now, how am I going to slap him on the right cheek? I've got to do that. What does that look like? It looks even more dismissive, doesn't it? And again, really interesting, talking to Hussein and Marjan, they knew that instinctively and said that's doubly worse. It's the action of a superior to one who is inferior. It's a pathetic person. And in legal terms, in Jewish terms at this time, that was reflected in the fact that in a court of law, double damages would be paid for that, for a slap like that with the back of the hand. So you see how understanding it culturally helps us to see why Jesus says the right cheek is not just a random bit of information. This is not talking about physical harm, what we might call GBH. It's an assault on my dignity. It's when those times in life where I suddenly feel incredibly indignant and feeling like I need to defend myself, my honor. Something's been said about me, perhaps in public, in the hearing of others. And, you know, I start to smart, as we'd say, or I feel the color rising in my cheek. It's that sort of humiliation that's going on here. It's important to make it clear this is not an abuse situation. Jesus is never condoning abuse. This is not a reason for spouses, for example, to not resist the evil one and to stay in an abusive relationship. It's not that. It's about my personal dignity being under threat. Now, of course, on a personal level, this doesn't often feel like the right thing to do, does it? Turn the other cheek, which seems to imply continue to put oneself in a situation where you're going to be potentially on the receiving end again of that. Seems to just give the opportunity for bad people to think they can get away with their behavior. And if they can get away with it in your case, well, they'll do it in other cases as well. Isn't it better to stand up to people? I think, though, what Jesus is alluding to here is something actually we do know as well and do see, and actually is borne out by some people who've done research on that, when people respond without violence and in a very different way, it brings people up short. It changes the whole atmosphere. It kills the tit for tat. I guess that's the point. It completely kills the you hit me, I hit you back, and I insult you and you insult me back. Just it stops it. Stops it dead. There's a quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer who puts it like this in The Cost of Discipleship. The only way to overcome evil is to let it run itself to a standstill because it does not find the resistance it is looking for. Resistance merely creates further evil and adds fuel to the flames. But when evil meets no opposition and encounters no obstacle, but only patient endurance, its sting is drawn, and at last it meets an opponent which is more than its match. It demonstrates, doesn't it, when someone responds like that, that they're trusting in a higher court of justice. One writer, Barclay, comments that true Christians, get this, true Christians have forgotten what it is to be insulted. What makes you indignant for your pride, your dignity in front of other people? Are you able to be insulted? And actually, because you care so much about Christ, you care more for him, you're willing to do something which is better for the situation, good for the situation, even if it means you're not reacting and defending self because you recognize that self is not my God anymore. I don't need to defend. Sometimes the action will be a literal receiving a slap. Jesus is going to get that, isn't he, at his trial? So the one who gives this command will receive a literal slap, but most of the time it wasn't a literal thing. But what might it look like for you when you're at work or at school or in the family and people say something and you know what your natural reaction is? You find that humiliating. You've got to get a word in, a reaction in. I think we want to see here in these examples how Jesus is actually freeing us from the tyranny of self that says, I must react, I must justify myself. The Christian, though, is freed from the need to defend one's honor because there's a higher court of justice. God will do that. God will do that. I can be free from having to do that myself. So that's the first example, where my personal dignity is under threat. Second one is there in verse 40, where my personal rights are under threat. Jesus says, if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. Well, I think this is a point about not asserting one's rights. Because again, if we try and understand what's going on, the tunic and the cloak are two different items of clothing. The tunic is something worn next to the skin, the undergarment, as is sometimes translated, and the cloak, an outer thing, like a big sort of rug type thing that would protect you against the elements. You might sleep in it if you needed to. So they're two different things, which of course, you know, if you think about it, think how Jesus' listeners might have been smiling by this point, because if someone takes your tunic, let them have your cloak as well, what have you got left with? You're kind of left there standing in your drawers. And I think there is some hyperbole going on here in Jesus. He's saying things to get an effect and to make a point. And makes us sit up and think, you know, we might say, oh, I take the Bible literally. Well, yes, but taking it literally also means we need to understand what the person intends us to hear. I don't think Jesus expects his disciples from this point onwards to go on without clothes on. He's making a point. Culturally, in Jesus' time, a poor man had his right to his cloak defended in law. Let me show you the verse from Exodus 22. If ever you take your neighbor's cloak in pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down, for that is his only covering, and it is his cloak for his body. In what else shall he sleep? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. So a poor man had his right to his cloak defended in law. And so what Jesus seems to be saying is that a Christian does not assert his rights to the law and what it gives him his right to, even if it's his cloak, the thing that kind of keeps him alive, protects him from the elements. The Christian is not like the person of the world. The Christian does not feel the need to stamp their foot and assert his own personal rights. This is something that's totally at odds, isn't it, with our society, which will emphasize rights far more than responsibilities. Jesus is doing quite the opposite. But actually, when we look around and we're tempted to get livid about our rights, because that's what people do nowadays, we're encouraged to do that, actually that is another form of enslavement, an enslavement to self. Jesus, I think, is saying to us, I free you of your need to assert your rights the whole time. Jesus, of course, does that himself, doesn't he? Philippians 2. The one who was in the very form of God did not count equality with God something to be grasped. In other words, he gave up those rights to the glory of heaven and he emptied himself, took on the form of a servant. If you belong to Christ, you're above rights. I think sometimes as Christians in the UK, we need to take care that arguing for freedom of religion doesn't stray into wrongly defending my personal rights. I must have the right to wear this cross in the workplace. Let's submit that to Jesus' statement here. Yes, we want to defend the rights of others. This is a personal ethic, though, and I think there's something really attractive in someone who cares, not a jot about their own rights, but really cares for the rights of others, particularly those who can't speak up for themselves. Third example, verse 41, when my personal time and energy are taken advantage of. And this is picking up on what Jesus says about there in verse 41, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Now, again, at the time, a Roman soldier could compel anyone to carry their goods or their luggage, whatever, for a mile. And that person was required by law to do that. And the reason we feel pretty sure that Jesus is alluding to that is because the mile is a Roman unit, not a Jewish one. And also the forces word is quite a technical term and used in that military context. We see it one more time in the Bible. You might remember where it is. It's where the Romans compel Simon of Cyrene to carry Jesus' cross. So that is what's going on here in this verse, in this example. Well, how would you feel if you're going about your business, doing a job, rushing around, and then suddenly a Roman soldier stops you and says, right, need you, pick that up, you're coming with me, and okay, you've got to do that, otherwise you're going to get in a lot of trouble with him. Self doesn't like this. Self finds the blood rising. Self sees a whole load of reasons why I should do as little as possible for that Roman soldier. But we don't live for self anymore. We live for Christ. So our priorities are totally different. And we're freed. Jesus is saying, I'm freeing you from doing the minimum and going away with a grouch. And how might this behavior of doing the extra mile, how might it honor Jesus? Think about the possibility of being a witness to the soldier. We see often in the New Testament soldiers responding positively to the gospel. These are real people. It's not just a Roman soldier. It's a person who needs to hear the gospel. Let me ask you a question. During which mile, the first or the second mile, are you most likely to get a chance to witness to that soldier? In mile one, surely you're only doing what everyone else will do, what they have to do. You're no different from anyone else. Mile two, you're very different from everyone else. At that point, as you start the second mile and you're into the first few meters of the soldier, suddenly he doesn't just notice that you're there as his kind of donkey. You're a person. You're a different person. We're to serve in the world, not putting self first, but thinking of what we can do to serve others in a way that gives honor to Christ. It's interesting, isn't it? These two of these examples, turn the other cheek and go the extra mile, they've entered our vocabulary as phrases that people know. But how much do we actually know what they really mean? Go the extra mile is not just be willing to serve someone a little bit more. I think it's a willingness to subject self to a higher cause, to Christ's cause. So are you freed? Are you freed because you know there's a higher court? You know there's a greater priority? Are you freed from the world's games of one-upmanship, comparing ourselves with each other, superior, inferior roles? Do you have that greater concern that means you're willing to serve in a totally, totally different way to what the world would do, in order to show Christ for what he is? Last example. When my personal possessions are under threat. I think this one can feel like the most unrealistic in our society. And again, we need to bear in mind what's going on in Jesus' time. Give to the one, verse 42, give to the one who begs from you. Do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. As I was reading around this topic this week, I was on the tube and someone came up to me with a little box of tissues with a little note on it. You know, you'll have seen them do that, place it there, and of course, they're begging. They're asking for money. Or they're asking you to buy something, but it's essentially the same thing. So constantly, you and I, we're being asked for things, aren't we? People are begging. All the other examples, though, this should probably help how we come to this one. All the other ones are of people trying to do you over in some way, either harm you or make you look bad or use you. So I think we're probably meant to understand this one in a similar way. Demanding something they don't deserve by rights. And in light of that, it could well be the case that here's another example of that. It's rather than simple begging, it requires an understanding of the nature of borrowing and lending at the time. Because in Deuteronomy 15, I haven't got the verse here, but it talks about the sabbatical year, the seventh year, when anything that's been loaned, actually, you give up your rights to getting it back. It's called the law of release. And this might lead to someone, rather sneakily, borrowing something very close to that year, and then saying, oh, sorry, we've just got to that seventh year, which says that I can keep it. Great. So you can see how people would have used that and abused it. And in Deuteronomy, it addresses that and says, even in those situations, give. At the very least, the law of release would always be a factor in your thinking about lending and borrowing. So this is about lending in the knowledge that you may well not get it back, and there might be some slightly malicious motive behind it. They're actually just wanting to get your stuff. So perhaps primarily this is a point about how much you hold on to your stuff. You might not see it again. I don't think it's meant to be the final word about how to address beggars on Chiswick High Road. There's a great article about that, about begging, which can be a really difficult thing to do, can't it? We want to show love to people, but at the same time, I think most of us instinctively think, well, it's not going to help that person to receive money from me. If you want to read a good article on it, do come and ask me about that. It just gives pointers like, you know, give people time. Interesting, Jesus doesn't say give money to the one who begs from you. We can give time, we can give food, we can give friendship, we can treat them as a human being. But the Christian is being freed from being owned by my possessions. Well, that's a challenge, isn't it? Are you freed from your possessions owning you, enslaving you? When you see a need, when someone asks you for something, do you see what you will lose if you give it, or do you see what they will gain? Well, Jesus has laid down a principle. He's given us four examples of it. Two final things as we close, because this sort of passage is so easy to spend time thinking of ways that this doesn't work and it's not possible. And let me just encourage you and encourage us as we talk about it to actually aim for ways where it is possible, rather than, you know, it doesn't apply in this situation, does it? I'll get out of that one. It doesn't apply in this one. No, let's look for ways it does apply. And let's remember the gospel. If you're a Christian, then you are the recipient of Jesus' grace to you. I'm really struck by the fact that Jesus has really done all of these things for us, hasn't he? He's not defended his dignity when humiliated. He's not grasped his rights, as we saw in Philippians 2. He's gone the extra mile, traveled from heaven to serve as a slave, to put that tea towel around his waist and go to the cross of a slave. He's not held on to possessions. He's become poor so that I might become rich, as Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. This is the gospel. And isn't this effectively Jesus saying, this is what's been shown to you, you who have the Beatitudes being worked through your life so that your relationship with God and others is being transformed. It's been shown towards you, and we're being called to put it into practice, to be freed from the tyranny of self and instead to serve a far greater master, the Lord Jesus Christ. And that way we proclaim the kingdom, living like this. Easy, isn't it? Of course it's not. It's really hard. You and I are going to find it really hard to do these things this week, mainly because self, he hasn't died yet. His future is death, but he still makes his presence felt. Let's pray, shall we, and ask for his help. Father, help us as we continue to pray and think as Michael leads us. We thank you for this portion of your word. Teach us and train us through it in Jesus' name. Amen.